This is Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. In the next half hour, we'll take a brief look at the May 31st presidential elections in Colombia. While no one expected the first round of polling to be definitive, questions remain as to whether the winner of the second round will actually make a difference in the overall picture of that troubled country. We'll speak with correspondent Steve Dudley. Then we'll take a look at oil exploration in Latin America, specifically in Colombia and in Ecuador. The California-based Occidental Petroleum announced last week that it was not going to drill for oil in the indigenous territory of the UWA people of Colombia, but UWA supporters are concerned that this may be only a public relations ploy on the part of the multinational oil giant. All of this and more coming up next on Our Americas. May 31st marked the first round of presidential elections in Colombia, where four main candidates were vying to become the successor of the embattled Ernesto Samper Pizano. But as we've been reporting on Our Americas over the past several weeks, the elections were held in the midst of a rising tide of paramilitary violence and a general state of political turmoil, making some observers feel as if the vote was nothing more than a sideshow. No one was expected to win enough votes in the first round, making it almost certain that the Conservative Party candidate Andrés Pastrana and the Liberal Party candidate Horacio Serpa would face each other in a runoff on June 21st. Joining us now to discuss the voting is correspondent Steve Dudley, who's been reporting from Colombia for the last several months on Our Americas. Steve, what can you say has been the mood of the country in the days leading up to the elections?
The mood of the country is one that instead of thinking about a Sunday election or a June 21st runoff, they're more thinking about what's the country going to be like in 6 months or what's the country going to be like in a year. There's a sort of sense of that the people don't have any control over what the future may hold. And that means the people both in the local population and the politicians themselves. It's just everything seems to be spinning out of control. And so I think the people, when they think about the elections or they think about the next president, they're more thinking about the larger questions. What are the possibilities that within a year there may be peace negotiations? What are the possibilities that within a year the United States may cut off aid again? Things of that sort seem to be dominating what people are thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Naturally, the elections are taking place within the context of a series of massacres that have taken place in the last several months. I think the numbers are over 250 people who have been killed just since last October in massacres spearheaded primarily by right-wing paramilitary groups, which, of course, we've covered extensively here on Our Americas. Is there a sense that neither of the political candidates who had been politicking in the last few months can do anything about that situation?
Certainly, it's going to be hard for them to do anything about that situation. Number one, you have a situation where the military seems to be in deep crisis. There are several factions within the military that seem to be vying for control over that particular institution. So that particular institution doesn't seem to be headed in any one direction. Number two, you have a situation where the paramilitary seem to be more and more independent. Each day they seem to separate themselves farther and farther away from the government, and as the government begins to target them and imprison them, that situation will only grow worse. So the whole thing is, like I said, it seems to be growing, going in a direction that is almost incontrollable, and one candidate or the other will not be able to control what happens there. It seems like the candidates themselves can't even control the members of their own party, much less begin to think about controlling a massacre in a town where that has no roads that even connect it with the main cities.
Mm-hmm. Now, leading up to the elections, of course, and this seems to be a four-year ritual in Colombia, where political candidates try to gain points talking about peace and the need to have dialogue and negotiation. The guerrillas, primarily the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, have repeatedly said that the government is illegitimate, especially Samper's government, that they would be willing to consider negotiations afterwards. But in some case, in all respects, the successor of Samper is still going to be, to a certain extent, illegitimate. How is the Colombian state, the Colombian government, to regain, how is it going to regain its legitimacy in the wake of the elections, the June 21st runoff election?
I think the government is going to have to, unfortunately, create some alliances with some of the more questionable institutions, the first one being the military. They're going to have to create a situation whereby the people look at the military in a way in which they start to feel secure, or they start to feel like there is some sort of cohesion within the military. So I think the first thing that they're gonna try and do anyway is look towards the military and try and create a cohesive military. The second thing I think that either candidate's gonna do is going to try and shore up relations with the United States government, and that is another thing that's going to have an interesting effect and may have a backlash effect within Colombia. The minute any institution or any party starts to make alliances or connections with the United States government, they're going to run into some sort of backlash within Colombia, and this may worsen the situation. On the other hand, it may give them some sort of legitimacy down the road, and it may be the only way in which they can spin their way out of this just total crisis that they're in right now.
Of a permanent commission for peace, obviously the idea is kind of to construct something along the lines of Guatemala, where a peace process was not based on, say, a government, one president, but more so a policy of the state, and regardless of what government is in office, they're going to continue to do that. Is that possible? I mean, they keep talking about it in Colombia, but is that possible in the wake of the elections?
Yes, I think that it is possible, because you have started to see alliances that you never saw before, and especially among the civil society. There are members of the business community, members of union movements, members of student movements, members of peasant movements, who have all began to join together and create alliances that you never saw before in Colombia. And I think that will have an effect of also creating a more tolerable environment at the highest level. So you might have a sort of, at the lowest levels, you're going to have people creating these alliances, which will create a more tolerable environment for the upper levels. And I think that will include also members of the conservative and liberal parties, because they see also that the fragmentation of society has hit levels that only their grandfathers remember back, you know, from the 1950s during La Violencia.
Mm-hmm. Now, the broad front for peace that we've talked about in recent weeks, what impact could they have?
Again, that's exactly the sort of alliance that we're talking about, and they may not have a direct say in everything that goes on in a possible negotiation. They may not even be the ultimate provokers of, or they wouldn't be able to say, now it's time to negotiate. But what they can do is they can create an environment in which people look at the negotiations as the ultimate and only solution to the problem. And I think that's going to be their biggest help to the negotiations, that they will create the environment in which peace negotiations can occur.
Correspondent Steve Dudley has been reporting from Colombia for the past several months for Our Americas. In our final segment, also coming out of Colombia, there seems to be a break in the case of the UWA people's struggle against California-based oil giant Occidental Petroleum. Oxy officials said on May 26th that it would renounce its contract to exploit the Samare oil block in northeast Colombia in return for new rights to a small proportion of the area under different contract terms. The deal, which must still be approved by state-run oil company Ecopetrol, would end Occidental's long-running problems with the UWA indigenous community, which claims part of the original block as its ancestral homeland. At least that's what Oxy thinks. The 5,000-strong community had threatened to commit mass suicide if the U.S. oil giant pressed ahead with the controversial exploration and production contract signed 6 years ago. But the UWA working group of Project Underground, an environmental group spearheading a campaign to defend the UWA, is not so quick to say the struggle is over, and is cautioning not to overreact to an announcement spun by Occidental public relations officers. Joining us now to talk about this announcement is Terence Freitas, who's been working with Project Underground, heading up the UWA campaign. Terence, can we say that this is a kind of a sort of a victory for the UWA people?
It's definitely a partial victory, but I want to emphasize partial. It's that Occidental saying they're pulling out of 75% of the Samurai block is amazing. It's incredible, and it's definitely a tribute to indigenous resistance in Colombia and in Latin America. And it's a tribute not so much to the environmental NGOs or human rights NGOs like ourselves in the north, but really a tribute to the work on the ground that the UWA people have been doing in Colombia. They've just been doing an incredible amount of work to not become divided by the oil companies' tactics. So I really want to emphasize that the credit should go to them for the incredible organizing that they've been doing. And you know, as you know very well, that it's difficult to do that amount of organizing in Colombia without getting people killed.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us about the decision by Occidental. Is it something that that the UWA, have you been able to talk to the leadership of the UWA regarding this announcement by Occidental?
This news has caught not only the UWA, but the National Indigenous Organization of Colombia completely by surprise. It's really odd that that a company like Occidental would spend so much time and effort saying that they want to be transparent, they want to have dialogues with this tribe, and they want to make sure that this conflict gets resolved in a peaceful way. It's very odd that they would go ahead and kind of cut some what it looks like they're cutting a backroom deal with the Colombian government, and they got the first chance to make the spin at the press and basically present this whole issue as if the problem's been solved, and they're not going to drill anywhere where there's any kind of land conflict, and that's simply not true. If they're drilling anywhere where they've explored for oil, where they've cut seismic lines just north of what the government recognizes as UWA territory, that's dangerously close to even the government recognized territory, and it's also close to a national park. The really suspicious part of this deal is that Occidental refuses to release the point of sale, the new 25% of the Samurai block where they want to drill, and that sounds pretty suspicious to me.
So you're saying that they're publicly stating that they're not going to drill there, but they're still not letting go of the control of that part of the territory.
Basically, one of the kind of running themes in indigenous rights cases, both in North and South America, Latin America, is this land conflict. And once a government or a company can present the land conflict issue as being over and done with, a lot of times people kind of stop looking at the case and they feel like everything there's nothing else to really have conflict over. And the UWA, it gets a little bit complicated, but basically the UWA had applied for increased lands and amplification of their territory in 1993, and this has nothing to do with oil development. This has to do with they've had 90% of their lands taken away over the past 50 years, and that a lot of them are starving, basically, in the outer territories. They don't even have enough land to live on. Now, what the government's saying is that we're going to give the UWA some of this land back, and that's kind of a deal for oil development, and it appears that Oxy is giving the same spin. And so, but that's simply not the case. And it's really very disturbing that this news has come out without Occidental Petroleum releasing the information, which the UWA should be the first to know about this, releasing the information on where their drilling sites would be and what part of the Samurai block that they have. That is not consultation with an indigenous peoples, which is required by both Colombian and international law, and that's definitely not transparency of a responsible American oil company.
Mm-hmm. Terence Freitas is the coordinator of the UWA campaign of the California-based Project Underground, and he's been at the forefront of the U.S. organizing against Occidental Petroleum's intent to drill for oil in the territory of the UWA people of northeastern Colombia. Joining us also on the line is Judith Kimmerling, who is an environmental attorney and a professor of law and political science at the City University of New York, and she's done considerable work on the issue of multinational oil in Latin America, particularly in Ecuador, and she's the author of the book Amazon Crude, and she's been looking at the issue of public relations by multinational oil companies and trying to put a positive spin on the work that they're doing. Judith Kimmerling, what can you tell us? I mean, I know your focus hasn't been on Colombia per se, but from this announcement, is this another attempt of a multinational oil corporation to put a positive spin on the work that they've been doing in a particular country?
Well, I can't speak too much specifically to this announcement, and I think it's significant that the way it's coming out, that it's not really an announcement from Oxy. But certainly many of the things that I heard already in this interview sound very familiar. They sound very similar to what oil companies are doing in Ecuador and Peru and other parts of Latin America, and particularly in the Amazon rainforest. There is a major public relations effort by several companies to try to convince their critics, to convince the press and convince the public that they've changed, that they're different, and that they now recognize that environmental protection and respect for indigenous rights is an important component of developing oil fields. And several of these companies have been talking using this kind of language in their public relations in Ecuador for many, many years, and their facilities have only recently begun to go online, and some of them have still not begun operations. They're still in the planning stages. Occidental is one of the companies that promised to raise the standard of environmental protection and to work respectfully with indigenous communities in Ecuador. The problem, however, is that as they move from a public relations phase into actual operations, Occidental in Ecuador has tried to maintain a very low profile, and they haven't backed up their claims that they can extract oil without serious harm to the land and the peoples with the transparency or the information that's needed to verify them. So there's some serious questions about whether or not the promises that they're making in terms of environmental protection and consultation with communities are true.
Judith Kimmerling and Terrence, I want you both to comment on this, because it seems like there's two different, you've both been involved in two different areas and have two different results, if you will. I mean, if we look at the UWA situation in Colombia, it has been a situation of trying to stop exploitation of the territory before it's too late. And that's been successful up to this point in terms of the Occidental Petroleum not actually continuing its explorations, although they have the license to do so in Colombia. Whereas in Ecuador and Texaco specifically, Judith, the case and the struggle has been more about having Texaco be held accountable for the damage, environmental damage that it has caused. Why don't you talk a little bit about that, and maybe we can get Terrence to talk about the importance of this campaign to try to make a parallel between the two areas. Judith, first yourself.
Okay, that's correct. Texaco was a company that pioneered oil development in Ecuador, in the Ecuador's Amazon region, and it transferred petroleum technology to Ecuador. It built and operated the infrastructure that turned the country into a petroleum exporter. And there was really no consciousness within the Ecuadorian oil industry in the 1970s and the 1980s of the hazards, the environmental hazards of crude oil, because Texaco was the professor and it didn't teach any of the Ecuadorian nationals about that. And in fact, oil field workers in the 70s and 80s were so unaware of the hazards of crude oil that they used to apply it to their heads to prevent balding. And they would sit in the sun or cover their heads with a plastic cap overnight and then wash their hair with diesel to remove the oil. So when the world and the Ecuadorian public learned about the enormous pollution and widespread devastation that had been caused by Texaco in the Amazon region, there was a response that was outraged. It was as if everything that we had learned in this country had been completely ignored in Ecuador. So there has been an international boycott campaign to try to compel Texaco to clean up its mess in Ecuador. The idea is that if Texaco manages to walk away and leave this behind, it's really just a question of time as to when the Ecuadorian government or Ecuadorian nationals will have to face it and clean it up. And so the thinking is that Texaco should be held accountable, and that it's really going to require international pressure to compel Texaco to meet its responsibilities and clean up its mess. There's also been a lawsuit filed in federal court against Texaco, a federal court in New York. This is where Texaco's corporate headquarters are, and that lawsuit is trying to hold Texaco accountable as well. It's been dismissed by the district court, and it's been appealed to the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit.
Judith Kimmerling is an environmental attorney and a professor of law and political science at the City University of New York. She's the author of Amazon Crude. We're also on the line with Terrence Freitas, who is the coordinator of the UWA campaign of Project Underground. Terrence Freitas, your comments on the difference in terms of the organizing that you've been doing, basically in an attempt to stop Oxy as opposed to hold them accountable.
Really what we're doing is we're working on a prevention campaign where the destruction of the rainforest, of sensitive ecosystems, and the destruction of the lives and culture of indigenous people can be stopped before it starts. A lot of the work that we're doing really builds on Judith Kimmerling's groundbreaking work. And what we're trying to do is look at the case studies that she spent years of her life working on and try to prevent those case studies from happening with the UWA people in Colombia. And I think one really major point to remember right now that's kind of dropped out of the public's eye is that Shell is a full partner in this deal. They've been investing all over Colombia with Occidental Petroleum, and that they have 37.5% of the shares in this project, and none of the articles that have come out have remembered that. So I want to point that out, that Shell, although they said a few months ago that they were about to sell their shares in this project, they haven't sold those shares yet, and if this project goes through and they don't sell their shares, then they're going to still be fully responsible in a project that could potentially be genocidal. That's the first point I want to make. The second is really that that Occidental Petroleum right now in kind of a lot of their work right now is spin work. It's kind of public relations work, and along with that of the Colombian government as well. As far as one of the leading mainstream newspapers in Colombia, El Tiempo, is concerned, in an article yesterday, the problem is solved. You know, the land conflict is over. The drilling is going to take place. It says 6 hours away from the territory, from the UWA territory, and it'll be 15,000 feet underground, and it will have no impact on the indigenous, on this 1,000-year-old indigenous community. And it goes on, and the article might as well have been written by Occidental or by the Ministry of Mines in Colombia, because it was so one-sided that it didn't even have any contact with the UWA or the National Indigenous Organization of Colombia, or even mention that it made any attempts to contact those groups. And that's just that's outrageous.
I guess it's standard fare for multinational oil and complicit governments. But I wanted you, Terrence Freitas, to talk a little bit about who Roberto Cobaría or Berito is, who this person is. He won the Goldman Environmental Prize this year. He's been awarded a number of other prestigious human rights and environmental awards around the world. And he's somebody who's gotten a lot of attention, particularly because of the threat that was posed a few years ago about the mass suicide, which has gotten the most attention. But he has been struggling on many other fronts. So could you talk a little bit about him?
Sure. Berito Cuarua is his UWA name, and he was initially first known by his Spanish name is Roberto Cuarua. He is the president of the traditional UWA authority, and he's basically an elected spokesperson. The president of the UWA is a little bit different than the president of, say, the United States. It's basically a spokesperson for the tribe, and what the spokespeople do and what the leaders do is they go out, they talk to different communities, and they really do incredible community organizing. And then when decisions need to be made, say the equivalent of a bill or a law would need to be passed in the Uwa tribe, they would go back and then they would consult with their elders, and the decisions are made that way in a really democratic affair. And so what's really incredible about Roberto's work is that it's internationally recognized community organizing work. That's what the Goldman Prize is for. The Goldman Prize does not go to academics or people in government. It goes in kind of internationally recognized governments. It goes to people who are doing incredible on the ground community organizing work. And in doing that, a lot of the people that they give the prize to have had their lives threatened, and simply by the work that Roberto's doing in Colombia, which is fighting a multinational oil company, and just really, it's not so much fighting even directly against the company, it's just fighting for the rights of indigenous people in Colombia, particularly for the Uwa people. And in doing that in Colombia, is very, very dangerous. And so, just that he's doing that in the first place is incredible, and in the second place that he's gotten all this international attention, that he's been able to stave off an incredible amount of violence, of potential violence in both the Uwa territory and in areas surrounding the territory, that violence hasn't just erupted there yet, I think is in a large part a tribute to the leadership of Berito.
Terence Freitas is the Uwa campaign coordinator of the Project Underground, an environmental organization based in Berkeley, California. And that's about all the time we have on today's program. Our Americas is produced at the studios of WBAI Pacifica Radio in cooperation with NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America. It is funded in part by grants from the Paul Robeson Fund for Independent Media, the Funding Exchange, and the New York State Council on the Arts. Associate producers are Sarah Gill, Amy Standen, Walter Krakmal, and Laura Tarantini. If you have any questions or comments, you can send us an email at mmcompa@igc.org. That's mmcompa@igc.org. For Our Americas, I'm Mario Murillo. Thanks for listening, and stay strong.